It's truly my great pleasure to introduce Timothy J. Guilfoyle as the keynote speaker for this conference. Thanks to the generosity of our co-sponsors, we're able to bring in a noted scholar to talk about New York State history. Timothy J. Guilfoyle is Associate Professor of History at Loyola University in Chicago. He holds a BA and a PhD from Columbia University in New York City. He is author of City of Eros, which is a study of prostitution and the commercialization of sex in New York, published in 1992. That work won the Allen Nevins Award. It's a magnificent work, which is incredibly detailed. One of the best things about the book are all these maps where he shows you how visible prostitution was in New York by being able to see these streets that for 10 years would have brothels in the same places, and how the brothels and the sex districts moved with the commercialization of different aspects of New York. He's not going to talk about that book today, though. Actually, what he's going to talk about is something that he found, and this is what happens when you go into the archives. You're looking for something and you find something else. And what happened while he was doing the prostitution book is he ran across basically a typescript of a diary of a pickpocket from the late 19th and early 20th century. And so he is going to talk today about prison subculture, which is part of the underworld subculture of late 19th and early 20th century New York. While his talk is called How the Other Half Was Incarcerated, Prison Life in the Age of Reese, it is actually part of a larger study that is tentatively entitled A Pickpocket's Tale. Tim, please come to the podium.
Thank you, Richard. I first want to say thank you to the organizing committee and the Researching New York History Conference for allowing me to participate today. Since I have all of you here in the same room, I think I should also thank the archivists at the New York State Archives. In certain respects, I would not be here today if it hadn't been for their help more than a decade ago when I was working on City of Eros, and more recently in the past 5 or 6 years when I've been working on this current project. I'd like to begin with a story. On the 15th of April in 1874, George Appo was admitted to Sing Sing Prison. Appo had grown up in what Jacob Riis described as the maze of narrow and unsuspected passageways down in New York's Five Points neighborhood, specifically in Donovan's Lane, just around the corner from the infamous Mulberry Bend. Appo was the offspring of a Chinese father and an Irish immigrant mother, raised on the street, where he eventually became a newsboy and soon learned to support himself by picking other people's pockets. Over time, he became an opium addict, engaged in fraudulent counterfeiting activities, and was incarcerated for over a decade in 10 different prisons. In 1894, his description of these and other activities before the Lexow Committee, investigating municipal corruption in New York, generated front page attention in the city's newspapers and penny press. Most extraordinarily, for our purposes here, as Richard mentioned, George Appo also wrote his own autobiography. Although he was only 17 at the time of his first admission, and he thought he was 15, and by some accounts he looked it, Appo had remembered that he suffered from what he described as a bad reputation. And he was immediately assigned to work in the prison laundry room, a place that the temperatures would sometimes rise to 150 degrees during the course of the day. I was at work only 3 days when the paid instructor of the contract put a dozen shirts on my table, saying, "You will have to do these shirts today and see that they are perfect." I told him I would do my best, but unfortunately, while on the third shirt, I accidentally scorched it. I reported the accident to the citizen instructor, and he went to the keeper and told him that I willfully burned the shirt. The keeper said to me, "Go get your hat and coat." I did so, and he and the instructor took me to the guard room, where the principal keeper, or PK as they were called, reported me to him as willfully and deliberately burning shirts. "What have you to say about it?" asked the PK. "It was an accident, and I could not help it," I said. "Accident, hey? Couldn't, hey? Well, we'll make you more careful after this. Take off your clothes." "By principle, it was an accident. I could not help it." "Take off your clothes," he again demanded. And as I did not respond quick enough, a big 6-foot keeper and another grasped me by the throat, tore off my coat and pants, knocked out my front teeth by shoving me violently over the paddleboard, pulled my hands behind my back, and handcuffed me. As I lay across the paddleboard, the keeper took a board shaped much like a canoe paddle with small holes in the blade, swung it over his shoulders, and brought it down with all his might on my bare back and spine. I counted 9 blows and became insensible. When I came to, I was lying on the floor, and the doctor said, "He's all right now." The keeper said to me, "Do you think you can go back and do your work? If you don't, we have a way to make you." I replied, "You punish me for nothing, and the next time I am brought here, you will punish me for something. No insolence. Take him back to the shop." When I got back to the shop with my teeth knocked out and my body black and bruised from the paddle, I took the shirts that were on my table across the shop to the stove, kicked open the stove door, and put the shirts into the fire, and slammed the door shut again. I was brought again over to the guard room and asked why I did it. I would not answer, and he said, "Put him down again." But the doctor said, "No, lock him up in the dungeon." So they took me to the dark cells, and I lay there for 14 days on 2 ounces of bread and a gill of water every 24 hours. And when I was taken from the dark cells, I was carried to the hospital, injured for life. Stories like this, however embellished, were emblematic of 19th century prison life. Prison life, punishment and tortures, sometimes called third-degree methods or hard-boiled discipline, were a common part of life in Sing Sing. Prior to 1847, flogging and whipping were the most popular punishments. Thereafter, the buck, or the crucifix, the shower bath, and the cap, or bishop's mitre, were frequently employed. In 1864, Sing Sing officials acknowledged issuing over 1,400 punishments to less than 800 inmates, including one who was punished by these methods 22 times. Public opposition eventually convinced the legislature to abolish all kinds of corporal punishment, excepting the dark cell, in 1868. In their report, Sing Sing administrators emphasized that most punishments did not involve physically assaulting convicts. As in Apo's case, officials usually resorted to the dark cell, also called the cooler or the dungeon, really an early version of solitary confinement. Although the state passed legislation in 1847 providing for the erection of separate cells for disobedient convicts, the cells remained unbuilt until 1879. Instead, Sing Sing officials used ordinary cells, 3.5 feet wide, 7 feet long, and only about 6.5 feet high, covered up all the sources of light, and removed all furnishings except for the slop bucket. In some cases, inmates were shackled to the floor of the cell for days, if not weeks, at a time. The use of the dark cell continued well into the 20th century. Prison officials and outsiders alike conceded this was a harsh punishment. Colonel J.L. Broom of the United States Marine Corps, upon entering the cell of a prisoner incarcerated for 18 days, noted that the odor inside was so exceedingly foul, I could not remain in it longer than a minute. An Auburn warden believed that they were more inhumane and barbarous than the whip. Another simply concluded that the dark cells were the cruelest and meanest punishments used here. Apo's ordeal also illustrated how prison officials routinely ignored the ban on corporal punishment. As with Apo, the most common resort was the paddle, literally a 25-by-4-inch board perforated with holes. Upon striking the victim, by one account, the apertures acted like suckers, which raised blisters on the flesh and sometimes brought parts of it away. One principal keeper admitted that some convicts received 100 to 200 blows. Most submitted, like Apo, after less than a dozen. The punishment remained in effect until at least 1882. Furthermore, Sing Sing guards and agents were permitted to strike inmates arbitrarily. "We have no rule any more than judgment," testified one Sing Sing keeper. Guards, keepers, and contractors admitted that punishments occurred hastily and went unreported. Foremen in shops, for example, punished inmates on the shop floor for refusing to work or performing work poorly. In other cases, keepers sent convicts to the dark cell before asking the principal keeper. Perhaps the most ingenious solution to the restriction on corporal punishment was the pulley, or the weighing machine. If the dark cells were filled, and they frequently were, or an inmate received a third reprimand, the individual was tied to a panel by his thumbs or his wrists, then suspended by his toes, barely touching the floor, reminiscent, according to one, of the weighing machines used by butchers. Once suspended, the rope cut into the prisoner's flesh, numbing their hands and arms. One visitor wrote, "I'm quite satisfied from my experience that a man subjected to it for 5 minutes must be severely injured, as both my thumb joints were painful for 2 days from the effect of 40 seconds tricing up. Keepers said inmates were often triced up for an hour. As early as 1870, the pulley accounted for over half of Sing Sing's punishments. Prison officials justified the method because the punishment was short and convicts feared it. Without the weighing machine, argued one, life in the prison would be unbearable for the keepers. From the day of his appointment as Sing Sing warden in 1880, Augustus Brush described the weighing machine as the safest, the quickest, and the most humane method of punishment ever devised. Superintendent Isaac Baker even demonstrated the punishment to the then New York Governor Grover Cleveland, who reportedly approved the method. The most desperate convicts avoided both work and torture by self-mutilation. Appa, while working in the stove works, actually witnessed Martin Moran intentionally incinerate his foot to avoid punishment. Warden Brush admitted that if Sing Sing prisoners can maim themselves in some way, they will do it. Prison critic Irving Ward charged in 1886 that one stove shop prisoner deliberately thrust his hand into a pot of molten metal and burned his fingers off to escape the cruel labor. Another put out his eye with a rat tail knife. One even cut four of his fingers off. The same year, a prisoner named Gallagher, unable to meet the daily requirement in the foundry, deliberately plunged his hand into a ladle of molten iron, claimed one report. The flesh fell off the member, the bones shriveled and twisted together, and the man fainted away. Unfortunately for Appa, the year of his admission witnessed a surprising increase in punishments. From 1873 to 1874, punishments rose from 364 to 682, roughly an 87% increase, 56% of which were in the dark cell. By 1876, over 1,400 punishments were meted out, marking it roughly a fourfold increase over the three-year period of Appa's incarceration. And by then, over 1,000 were punishments in the dark cell. Reliance on physical punishment was partly the result of the low number of guards. Between 1868 and 1885, Sing Sing employed between 30 and 42 guards, generating a guard-to-inmate ratio as high as one guard for every 69 prisoners. By contrast, in our own time, in the late 20th century, prisons employ on the average one guard for every four or five inmates. Harsh, senseless punishment affected inmate life in two fundamental ways. The first came in the form of resistance, specifically escaping. Not surprisingly, escapes from Sing Sing were quite common, especially before the completion of the surrounding wall in 1879. Most people don't realize this, but before 1880, there was no wall around Sing Sing. There still is actually a train line going through the yard. From 1870 to 1876, Sing Sing official reports reveal an average of over 10 escapes annually. The year that Appa was admitted, 1874, Sing Sing officials conceded that convict escapes were, quote, so frequent and effected with such apparent ease that a network of former keepers and burglars were systematically assisting convicts with their escapes or so-called French leaves. The second impact of this torturous punishment was that it successfully suppressed organized inmate resistance. Consider inmate life in the 20th century, in our own time. Most prisons since 1960 have been dominated by prison gangs, sometimes with memberships exceeding 100. Many of these gangs are motivated by militant political ideologies, display a rhetoric or a vocabulary associated with various social movements based on race, religion, gender, or politics. They benefited from greater internal freedom, such as access to television, physical exercise, college extension courses, even libraries. And they display a limited interest in social change within their communities. Such inmates consider the gang a surrogate family and a source of personal identity. Despite the mutual geographic and generational associations Appa enjoyed with his Sing Sing inmates, collective action and resistance by inmates was infrequent and rare. During Appa's first term in Sing Sing, over 16% of the 1,800 new inmates entering Sing Sing were 19 years or less, many of them literally Appa's teenage neighbors from Five Points. Appa never discovered even a limited sense of community or camaraderie with these inmates. These neighbors, both in and out of Sing Sing, never produced an oppositional prison culture comparable to that found in the second half of the 20th century. Even among pickpockets, Appa found few friends. At least a dozen of the nation's leading pickpockets, as identified by New York Police Inspector Thomas Burns in his famous book, Professional Criminals of America, at least a dozen of those served time alongside APO between 1874 and 1876. APO never discussed any kind of interaction with them. Rather, the harsh, coercive, military-style discipline of 19th-century prisons stifled gang recruitment and inmate opposition. Guards exercised arbitrary power and punishment. Inmates were granted only one personal visitor every 2 months. Newspapers were prohibited. Inmates experienced a more physically coercive internment with the lockstep, corporal punishment, hard manual labor, and poor sanitary conditions. Courts treated inmates as prisoners of the state, slaves of the state, and offered no access to the legal system. In general, inmates enjoyed few supporting institutions on the outside, effectively cutting off inmates from external society. In Sing Sing, privileges and benefits were based on individual and personal circumstances. Power rested in guards and keepers, not gangs of prisoners. Even within a congregate system, Sing Sing saw no prison rights movement emerge and little organized protest. When opposition emerged, it was usually spontaneous, individual, personal. Rare was the riot or the prison-wide protest. There was no Attica, you might say, in 19th century prisons. 19th century inmates, most seeking simply to survive, more often accommodated with than resisted authority. Rather, that was what APO did. Actually, that was what APO did during his ensuing 2 terms in Sing Sing. As APO attested, prison broke the spirit of many an inmate. But like APO, it did little to change their behavior. Depressed, dispirited, and in his words, injured for life, APO was finally released from Sing Sing on April 2, 1876. Not surprisingly, he quickly returned to pickpocketing. In the early part of June 1879, I was arrested on Broadway on suspicion by Detective Wolsey. As he punched me in the face for demanding why I was arrested, I punched him back. And for this, I was sent to the workhouse for 6 months. I was about 3 weeks in the workhouse when I made up my mind to try and escape from there. I managed to get a little steel saw brought over from another prisoner by a visitor. A night guard who made his rounds every half hour and after 9 p.m. would never count the men in the big cells. So I cut the bar of the window, and one stormy, rainy night at about 1:35 a.m., pulled the bar out and lowered myself from the top window to the ground by strips of a blanket. I went to the river and tried to swim across to New York, but the tide was too strong, so I swam under the boathouse. As the big sweep boat pulled up, I climbed up to get in as quietly as possible. I unhitched one pulley at a time, first lowering the bow a little, then tying the rope, going over to the stern, lowering that end down, and so on, until I got the big boat on the water. Then, to make matters worse, I found the boat had a double bow and no place to scull it. I had to pull on one oar and then climb over the seat, pull on the other oar. In all events, I got the big boat safely across, although I came being nearly run down by a passing steamer. On reaching New York, I tied the oars to the seat, pulled out the plug, and sunk her at the dock. Then I walked in my underclothes, I could relate to this now, to a tenement house, and by good luck, I saw a pair of overalls lying on the bedroom window. I took them, put them on, and rolled up the bottoms about 10 inches. I then took a Third Avenue car and rode downtown to Mulberry Street, where I got some clothes. The next day, I left New York for Philadelphia. Incarceration on Blackwell's Island marked a sharp departure from Sing Sing in more ways than one. By 1870, Blackwell's Island was the nation's largest medical center, home to the nation's first municipal insane asylum, as well as smallpox, epileptic, paralytic, and charity hospitals, the latter of which was described as probably the largest hospital on the continent. Here resided, as one said, the indigent of all ages, the blind, the afflicted, the insane, the inebriate, and for the correction of the criminal. In so many words, Manhattan's human refuse. On Blackwell's Island, wrote Jacob Riis, the nether half hides its deformities. By some measures, nothing better illustrates the failure of prison reform than Blackwell's Island. Reformers and city officials alike hoped that these distinct institutions would separate the young from the old, men from women, hardened felons from simple misdemeanants, the indicted from the convicted. Such ideals rarely conformed to the reality of Blackwell's Island. Honest observers admitted that distinctions between the penitentiary, the workhouse, the almshouse, and the charity hospital were rather nominal than actual. As early as the 1850s, the almshouse governors complained that the courts and magistrates treated the penitentiary as a sort of general receptacle for the sweepings of the city. diseased prostitutes with their victims and associates, paupers, drunkards, and vagrants of all sorts, the lame, the maimed, and the blind, the half-idiot, reek of lust and appetite, thieves, rowdies, and ruffians, children without parents or a home, old and hardened offenders. These all are to be found congregated together within the walls of the penitentiary. And at various times, children under 15 years of age were found in all four institutions. A major reason for such institutional overlap and inmate intermixing was, pure and simple, overcrowding. From 1870 to 1900, the daily population on Blackwell's Island fluctuated between 6,000 and 8,000 daily, more than doubling New York State's penitentiary population, which was then the nation's largest, roughly 3,000 to 4,000. The penitentiary's approximately 750 cells accommodated a daily population between 900 and 1,000. Overcrowding in the workhouse was even worse, the population exceeding 1,500, doubling that of the penitentiary. For the remainder of the 19th century, nearly half or more of the penitentiary cells contained two inmates. Indeed, until the introduction of bunk beds late in the century, penitentiary inmates shared the same bed. At times, the workhouse was so overcrowded that cells housed four inmates apiece. In 1890, a grand jury pointed out the paradox. Is it not absurd to indict for nameless crimes against nature when these very evils are fostered and bred within the prison walls through a vicious system of doubling up? Some identified the Blackwell's Island Penitentiary as one of the worst governed prisons in Christendom, others as simply a correctional dunghill. Like state penitentiaries, inmates and patients far outnumbered administrative personnel, including guards and keepers. In the penitentiary, for example, one guard or keeper was responsible for 40 to 50 inmates. Island officials barely kept track of who was sent to the island, counting inmates irregularly, if at all, as in Abbas' case. Furthermore, outside visitors came and left almost at will. One warden admitted that people from the city have come over here almost every day of the week until it unpleasantly broke up the discipline of the prison. Inadequate numbers of guards in a constantly overcrowded prison made control of the inmate population extremely difficult. Consequently, some guards resorted to simple brutality to maintain order. Yet, Abbo's experience suggests keeper cruelty on Blackwell's Island was much less frequent than in Sing Sing and other state prisons. Sinclair Tusey of the Prison Association testified that the numerous keepers were not just incompetent men, but habitual drunkards. Some, upon arriving for work, he wrote, proceeded directly to the infirmary, declared themselves sick, and spent the workday working off a hangover. Others were so inebriated, he maintained, that they simply fell asleep on the boat. More importantly, keepers and wardens alike fraternized with inmates. It is notoriously known, complained one citizen, that one of the wardens has been caught in criminal connection with one or more of the prostitutes under his charge. Others describe the inmates as, quote, the associates of the very keepers over them, sometimes their own relations. In 1876, one keeper let two inmates take an outing, permitting them to row across the East River and visit the nearby saloons. When it came time to return, one refused, while the other one fought with the keeper, fell into the river, and drowned. The Times editorialized that this sort of amusement is a common one. Fittingly, one workhouse superintendent complained that the only difference between the guards and the prisoners is that the latter are locked up while the guards are not.